It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Dialogue Conspiracy coming from Carmel, California, December the 6th, 1976. And this is number 246. 246 programs of Dialogue Conspiracy. I will be speaking most of the day today on new developments in the Howard Hughes story. Howard Hughes was buried this last year, April 1976, or at least that's the way the original cover story goes. And those of you that know my work on Dialogue Conspiracy and the article that I've written on Howard Hughes, you know that I don't believe that he was buried at that date. So that naturally I follow all the news that has taken place since this alleged burial. And I'm going to give you some up-to-date pieces of information that have been in the news just this past week that pertain to the Howard Hughes case. First, before I go into that, I do have a confession for Dialogue Conspiracy. I've studied so many government conspiracies, assassinations, and been suspicious of many things that have come along, but the most suspicious I've been of the swine flu, also the Legionnaire case back east in Pennsylvania. But I didn't have much credence in that Fort Dix swine flu story, and I didn't believe that the gentleman who ran around with pneumonia and expired had really had swine flu, and I never trusted Gerald Ford, who quickly authorized a minimum of $135 million for the swine flu shots. I didn't trust his motivations because Ford has vetoed every kind of a domestic bill, including health bills, along the line. He's notorious for that, and he jumped on the bandwagon of one case that took place at an Army base, and therefore I didn't have much credence in it. But I have a confession to make. I did the dumbest thing. It was just a set of circumstances that have no rhyme or reason, and the occasion was in my home when a doctor was there, my ex-husband, who brought up some swine flu, and I put down Gerald Ford so much and the swine flu so much and followed it with so much sarcasm and disbelief, and then, like playing Russian roulette or just being stupid or silly at the moment and not using my good judgment, I went ahead and had the swine flu shot. And I might add that for those of you that haven't had it, that it wasn't a very intelligent thing to do. I was being silly and putting down the medical profession for going along with it. And I paid the consequences because I've been sick all week and it was pretty bad. And I don't think it's anything to play around with, and I don't have any more confidence in the shot or in the disease that is supposed to be called swine flu than I had before. I'm ashamed of myself for taking it, but I have to make the confession. I looked at my recent articles on the swine flu, the headline articles. A few of them read public balks at flu shots. One was blacks poor in nation shun swine flu shots. Another one, flu campaign lagging badly. Another headline, few getting flu shots. Another one saying public turning away from vaccinations. Another one with health group warning against swine flu. And then there was a story in Missouri of the swine flu case that was supposed to be a swine flu. And then the reports the next day said that they doubted the test that this was a swine flu. And then the best article I have, it was from the Las Vegas Sun, had to do with the Missouri swine flu and said that even though this particular person, Larry Hardison, didn't necessarily have the swine flu that they diagnosed at Fort Dix, that he did work with pigs, with actual swine, and that his disease was similar to the disease you get when you work with swine. The article in the paper, the San Francisco Chronicle today, and you may get it in your newspapers, has mention of the government making swine flu back as early as 1955 to 1969. There's an article in the New England Journal. There's a new journal out of Medical Review that says New England Journal of Medicine. And I think it'd be important to look this up. It's called Swine Flu in Iowa, and it's dated 1976. New England Journal of Medicine claims that the United States government has been making swine flu antigen since 1955. And this comes from three doctors at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Washington, D.C. And they claim that it was included in their annual military formulations and that the vaccines were available to military dependents and certain government employees. And the doctors from Walter Reed don't say who the certain government employees were that were chosen for the swine flu. But 1955 to 69 coincides with the CIA operations that were taking place under the Directorate of Science and Technology when they were doing their LSD experimentations. And the swine antigen was being made by the military. So Dr. Robert Mendelson wrote an article asking certain questions. He said, why were these inoculations given at this time as early as 1953 to 63 or to 69, 55 to 69? He asked, if the vaccine was manufactured and administered for at least 15 years, why is there so much difficulty in getting it started this year? What was the problem? And the third question he asked is, why did the government have to accept insurance liability at this time if they've been manufacturing swine flu vaccine since 1955 to 69? And then he asked, why wasn't the same vaccine given now that they've been using for military personnel? And then the last question, why has this information been buried in obscurity of the New England Journal of Medicine? Those are all good questions, and they go back again into the government experiment of behavior and mind experimentation and health. The government should stay out of the health business and give it to private laboratories and private doctors working in universities. And I think the Army should stay out of this kind of work. But evidently, they were making swine antigen from 55 to 1969. So the military has been interested in the swine flu for a long time. And the question is now, is what they're giving out a continuation after the test? And what is in the swine flu? I'm sorry I had, as I say, I did it as a joke, and I don't advise anyone to do it. I've been sick all week, and it's pretty bad. What I had after the shots was pretty bad. And other people that I've spoken to have been sick, the few people that had the bad judgment to take it. So stay away from it. And only 16% of the country have had the shot, so stay away with the majority and don't get them. Well, there's an attorney in Houston, Texas. His name is Tyler Moore. I've mentioned him before on Dialogue Conspiracy, and he was written up in Time Magazine. He has a newsletter that you can get if you're interested in Howard Hughes. It's $200 a month or $3,000 a year, and it goes into the litigation of lawsuits against Howard Hughes or the Hughes estate taking place in Texas, Nevada, and California at the same time. And he sends out a summary of what is happening because the Hughes estate is going to open up into what I believe is the answer, both the answer and the mystery of our last 40 years. I think the Howard Hughes story is at the center of the mystery of a lot that I've studied. And there are articles, as I say, in the newspaper this week that I'll share with you and then give an analysis in the time that remains on why I believe the Howard Hughes story is so important. As Taylor Moore said, this was a syndicated interview he had about Howard Hughes, and he's working on just the details of the estate and never entertained the idea that Howard Hughes has been dead for quite a long while. He was quoted as saying, "This case is covered in secrecy. It is one of the great mystery stories of all time, and the more I study it, the more mysterious it becomes." And I think this is true. The Howard Hughes story covers the era from the end of World War I until the present time. It's still affecting our lives, and it is the greatest mystery story upon which all the other layers of mysteries meet. They all come into the Hughes story and connect, or almost all of them that I've studied. And as I put the pieces of the puzzle together, and I've only been working on it 13 years, more and more, I believe that the Howard Hughes story is the big story of cover stories, lies, deceptions, drugging, murder, kidnapping, controlling our politics, controlling our news media, controlling our courts of law and our justice system. Now, one of the interesting articles this week on Howard Hughes is an article from the Los Angeles Times. It was in the San Francisco Chronicle. It's a UPI story, which means it's covered by the United Press, but I take 10 papers a day, and I haven't seen it in any of the other papers I take yet. It's only in the, so far in the San Francisco Chronicle. It was the other day, and it's titled "The Used Gift, $30 Million." It says the existence of another document that purportedly bears the signature of the late Howard Hughes was disclosed yesterday. Public Administrator Bruce Altman told of the document, which would dispose of more than $30 million, this is of Howard Hughes' $2 billion, in a memorandum to county supervisors. According to the document, $30 million is to be shared by two men, Robert Morgan and Edward M. Barbara, for unspecified services to Hughes, who died last April. Now, that is shocking and should be making the headlines. There is a total news blackout on many of the articles that I'm reading now, and it concerns me a lot. Jerry Polakoff wrote an article on the New York Times suppression of evidence of the John Kennedy assassination, and there have been books written about the Fifth Estate and about news media, but I don't think anybody that I know realizes or yet has speculated on just how tight the news is from reaching all people across the country simultaneously or generally being carried in their hometowns. A story about a Robert Morgan and Edward M. Barber being named for inheriting money from Howard Hughes would be a story in itself, because when Mr. Dulmar inherited $130 million, which we're not clear yet that he's going to get, saying that Hughes gave him a quarter when he was in Las Vegas, there isn't one person of the establishment news media who yet has said anything about who is Edward M. Barbara and who is Robert Morgan, that they got $30 million. They haven't been photographed. They haven't been identified. There's no curiosity out of the press or media to think they'd look up who these people are. And I've been doing studies on Howard Hughes for the last 13 years or 10 years, and those names don't ring a bell. Another part of this will does ring a bell, though. And this document is dated February the 11th, 1966. And that's the approximate time in 1966 when Hughes began to disappear. There was a Hughes that went into Vegas in November of 66, but one Howard Hughes went from Hollywood to a Boston hospital where he had operation on the brain or mysterious surgery of some kind, not by Boston doctors, but people brought in from Florida, from the Medical Foundation, Hughes Medical Foundation. And Hughes was not functioning. He wasn't seen since 1957, and not functioning after middle of 66. But this was dated February the 11th, 66. But in this will, there's two more recipients, and those of you who study the various conspiracies or listen to me on this show for any number of weeks know these names. One of them is Sheriff Peter J. Pitches of Los Angeles County, and the other is Police Chief Edward Davis. And each of them, according to this will, would receive $200,000 a year for life. Now, there were allegations that whoever was you said, "I want to own the White House, or I want to own the law enforcement, or the sheriffs, or the district attorneys, or the police department." But it's interesting because Hughes hasn't been seen since 1957. At what point Peter Pitches enters into the Hughes saga? I myself know and have put the pieces together. And I would just say right now on the air that I believe it's a payoff. And I believe it's a payoff for a lot of crimes that could be exposed in the near future or not too long from now, and that these men want to be covered. They want all their angles covered. And I'm very suspicious of this. I know that the same time that this story broke about Chief of Police Ed Davis inheriting $200,000 a year for life from Howard Hughes, I read that the Black Panther Party as a group has filed a $100 million lawsuit against the FBI, the CIA, Army Intelligence, Postal Service, the Treasury. Now, if that lawsuit gets to the police department, the Berkeley Police Department, the Los Angeles Police Department, where the Black Panthers were harassed and people like Geronimo Pratt were framed, and a lot of the Black Panthers had ammunition dumped in their house, and they had busts, and Louis Tackwood was used from the criminal conspiracy section to get the Panthers, and two Panthers were shot at the UCLA campus by agents that worked for Chief of Police Ed Davis. For these kind of reasons, Ed Davis would need a lawyer if these if this comes to court. Also, the families of the guards at San Quentin, I've mentioned, the ones that were killed at the shootout when George Jackson was killed, have something like a $30 million lawsuit against the Los Angeles Police Department, and they will subpoena documents. Strangely enough, Lewis Tackwood was the agent for the Los Angeles Police Department at the time of the shootout of George Jackson when he was killed at San Quentin. And Lewis Tackwood testified at the trial of the San Quentin Six that the Los Angeles Police Department brought in the gun that was fatal, that shot the guards and was responsible for the shootout of the prisoners and the guards. That was in the summer of 1971. And I just learned this week that Lewis Tackwood, having worked for the Los Angeles Police Department as an agent provocateur for 9 years, and being a defendant in this case, he broke the case open. Evel Younger, the attorney general of the state, becomes Lewis Tackwood's attorney. So Tackwood has exposed the links of Evel Younger to Donald DeFries and also to the criminal conspiracy section in Los Angeles, and their links to the CIA in Washington, D.C., and links to James McCord and E. Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy. So this lawsuit of the family of the guards of San Quentin is very important, and Ed Davis is on the hotline. When we get Watergate West, and that's what I call really Watergate West, is the Sheriff Peter Pitch's connections to military intelligence and the formation of the Manson family, the use of the Manson family as a military operation and not a bunch of hippies on a commune, guitar-playing hippies. Sheriff Peter Pitches was the gentleman in charge of the area where Manson lived, the Spahn Ranch. The sheriff's group were the ones that arrested Manson the first time and then released him and released all the family, and they went out to the Mojave Desert to the Barker Ranch. But Sheriff Peter Pitches has a man, Hugh McDonald, that worked for him the same time he worked for Howard Hughes, that worked for the CIA at the same time. He held three jobs at the same time, CIA, Sheriff's Department, and Howard Hughes, and they're all really one. And Hugh McDonald would know a lot about what came down in the Los Angeles scene and still does. But a lawsuit by the Panthers or the guards' families may bring out a lot of things, and I believe that this kind of a will for Chief of Police Ed Davis, it would be payoff money, and I can't see it any other way that the Hughes estate comes up with $200,000 a year for Pitches and Davis. Not only was Pitches in charge of this Manson operation, but that Spahn Ranch, where the Manson family stayed, was Howard Hughes' scene for the outlaw. I think I've mentioned that on KLRB. That's where he used to go with Jane Russell, and he knew George Spahn and the outlaw set was there. And the Spahn Ranch borders right up to 30 acres to the Krupp property owned by the German munition manufacturers. So that what was once a haven of the Ku Klux Klan and the Nazis and the white racists of the White Aryan Guard, the Manson types, this was their safe house. It was the used property he used at his sets. What was the Spahn Ranch is going to be turned into a Hitler-type German Bavarian beer garden out in California. That's the Topanga Canyon headquarters. But I've met a man that worked for Sheriff Peter Pitches, who's now a private investigator, who talked about the involvement of the Sheriff's Department in the whole Manson story. And there are agents in common with the Hughes people, the CIA, the FBI, the Los Angeles Police Department, and Beverly Hills Police Department. And I think it's very interesting that this new will, it leaves $200,000 a year to two law enforcement officials that were responsible for so much of counterintelligence in the Los Angeles area. Another big operation that Ed Davis was in charge of was the Robert Kennedy assassination. And you remember it was Hughes who sent the memo that he believed Nixon could win in 1968 under his sponsorship and direction. And it was in Los Angeles, the home of Ed Davis, Chief of Police Ed Davis, who would inherit $200,000 a year for life from Hughes, the same man who said that he could make Richard Nixon president under his sponsorship, is now allegedly leaving a will for Ed Davis, who was in charge of the investigation of Robert Kennedy's assassination, when, again, the assassination involved a man named Thane Caesar from Lockheed, which is, again, synonymous with the CIA and Howard Hughes. And the can of worms, it fits together tighter all the time. so that the newspaper article about these two law enforcement officials, even the idea that they get this kind of money is scandalous. And I would make a conjecture. I don't make too many conjectures on KLRB and Dialogue Conspiracy, but I have to ask the question, when is Evel Younger, the granddaddy of the California conspiracies, or Mr. Raymond Pecunia, who was in charge of the prison system and then moved over nicely to the California mental hospitals at a time where we find that hundreds might have been murdered or probably murdered instead of just being confined to mental hospitals for whatever reasons. When is Evel Younger going to be named in a will that's planted or forged? He must get some kind of protection or payoff if these lawsuits are going to keep coming down. And how much money from this unlimited Howard Hughes $2 billion can be used to pay off the silent conspiracies that haven't been investigated yet? How much guarantee are these people going to get, and how much do they need? And I'm very suspicious of the fact that two unknown people, Robert Morgan and Edward M. Barber, don't step forward, and the media don't want to see them. And then two law enforcement people so synonymous with breaking up the Chicano movement, causing the riots at Isla Vista, killing Ruben Salazar, the Chicano writer that worked for the L.A. Times. This team is so synonymous with killing the Black Panthers, setting up the counterintelligence group, a criminal conspiracy section, the SWAT teams in Los Angeles. These two chiefs of law enforcement plus two unknowns are supposed to receive $30 million. And I think that the unknown should be investigated. And also what should be investigated is any links that Hughes actually had with these law enforcement people, because he himself, I don't believe, had. But it's a way of paying off for methods of control which were put into effect and which worked quite well for what they wanted to get accomplished. Now, one story about Howard Hughes that might break open my allegations that Howard Hughes was dead and buried at a Greek island would be dependent upon a man named Johnny Meyer, who worked for Howard Hughes. There was a John H. Meyer, he's still alive, he lives in Vancouver, who was a computer expert. He had to use Dynamics in California, a computer network that he fed Los Angeles Police Department files and arrests directly into the Salt Lake City databanks. It still may be going there every day. But Johnny Meyer was a computer expert. He was a procurer of people for government contracts for Howard Hughes in his early days. There were two John Meyers working for Howard Hughes. One is a John Meyer, the public relations man, who also was the public relations man for Aristotle Onassis. And there's John Meyer. Some people claim they're both one and the same. I can't separate two except by name and where they are, and I wouldn't know for sure to this day. It's very hard to, there's no photographs. I haven't seen a picture of Mr. Meyer or Meier. Their names aren't in the news very much. You don't see their picture. They both worked for Howard Hughes. But John Meyer got the Hughes people to buy some mines in Salt Lake City when they moved there, and they were way overcharged, and the Hughes people had a lawsuit against John Meyer for overcharging him for these mines. But they should know better than to sue a man like that, because he knows too much about the Hughes organization. Myers can't come back in the United States because there's a $100,000 bond that he's forfeited. He didn't appear in a federal court. It had to do with income tax evasion and mining claims. But Meyer is fighting a lawsuit of the Hughes people, the Summa Corporation, for they want him to put up money for these mines that were fraudulent, or they thought they were fraudulent. And he is at court in Salt Lake City. That's a fourth city where Hughes litigation is taking place that wasn't included in the original Mr. Moore's brochure. But now Salt Lake City is having some investigations. And the important thing is that Johnny Meyer is spilling the beans on the possibility of who Howard Hughes is. And I'll read you an article. This came from the Los Angeles Times. And again, this story is not syndicated. It didn't go Associated Press or United Press. The story I read earlier about the Howard Hughes gift to Peter Pitchess and Ed Davis only was in the San Francisco Chronicle. So now I jump to a story that should be making the wire services, that's only covered by the Los Angeles Times. The New York Times hasn't had it, or the Washington Post, or even my Salt Lake City papers. But this is what it says, and before I read it, let me remind you that when Howard Hughes' body was taken to Mexico in April 1976, the signature of entering Mexico was seen to be a forgery, and that Mr. Waldron, the aide, and two other aides of Howard Hughes were arrested immediately for forging Howard Hughes' signature, and they seemed to know the difference between an original or a forgery, and so they were arrested, and then they were let off, and I never heard anything more about those charges. But this article says, a top personal aide to the late Howard Hughes signed the billionaire's name on a $15 million bank loan because Hughes was not well enough to sign it himself. And then the aide wrote a memo, destroy this after using. Now, Howard Hughes was supposed to be weak and frail. There's a new book coming out that he was very bedridden and helpless and indecisive and couldn't enforce any of his orders. Mr. Phelan is coming out with that book. Random House is publishing it very soon. It'll be out in January. So you have one Howard Hughes that's very frail and half lunatic and can't get anything done. And then you have this other Howard Hughes that was supposed to take a loan just prior, in December, prior to his death by 6 months or 5 months, of in many millions of dollars. And one note on this loan, a $15 million loan, and there was, I'm talking about a $9 million civil suit against Johnny Meyer now, and Johnny Meyer claims that Howard Hughes was too sick and frail to sign the document just prior to his death of taking out $15 million, and he believes if that was a forgery and Hughes didn't sign it, and he has the proof now that Howard Hughes didn't sign the loan that took out many, many millions shortly before his death. If Hughes didn't sign that loan, then Johnny Meyer claims, how do I know that he signed the paper suing me? As I say, for his defense in the $9 million civil suit against Johnny Meyer, he's claiming, and he has a good argument now, that Howard Hughes couldn't possibly be suing him because he thinks those documents are forgeries too. So he's going to forge documents. If one is forged, then the other could be forged, and his lawsuit could be dropped, the suit against him be dropped, on the basis that Howard Hughes wasn't even strong enough or well enough to sign it. Now, John Myers hasn't got into the subject of whether Hughes was alive or dead, and I'm sure that that's his trump card. But this is the way the case is going. Howard Hughes, one-time scientific advisor, Johnny Meyer, told the court in Salt Lake City, this is last week, that he obtained from Mexico, where Howard Hughes was dying, and after he died and flew to this country, that he obtained papers that were seized by the Mexican authorities that were in the recluse's apartment. They had shredding machines up there, and they were tearing everything apart. But Johnny Meyer got a hold of a woman. He used an intermediary to go down to Mexico to get documents and to read these documents. And he found out that Hughes wasn't signing his name at all, even for a loan that added up between $15 and $40 million. Howard Hughes hadn't signed it. This LA Times article says the current court activity involves new questions raised about the most persistent aspects of Hughes in death as in life, whether someone else signed his name to the various documents and whether the documents were in fact written by other people. Now, this is the question that I'll be asking many times through the years, is did you sign anything after 1957, or was it signed by other people? So Meyer is saying, wait a minute, I don't think Howard Hughes signed these documents that he wanted to sue me. Meyer's attorney raised the question about the authenticity of this document. It was an affidavit purportedly signed by Howard Hughes and submitted to the court. And he showed this to them. It was from Mexico, and it was signed December the 4th, 1973. And he's claiming that Hughes didn't write it and he didn't sign it. And he wants to know who is writing Hughes' name and who is signing it. Several weeks ago, Mr. Washak, that's the attorney for Johnny Meyer, introduced into the court record what purportedly was a copy of a page of a Hughes affidavit of December the 4th, 1973. And there was a handwritten note on it. It was supposed to be signed by Howard Hughes, but it was written by Livar Mylar, Hughes' aide, and it said, no good, cannot use, and it was signed by Mylar instead of Howard Hughes. The document had an unsigned acknowledgement over the name of Mylar, a Hughes personal aide who's one of the directors of the Summa Corporation. Mylar had testified before that he did not write a notation on an unexecuted copy of the affidavit. Now, Johnny Meyer has gone down to Mexico and gotten one, so he shows that Mylar is not telling the truth on this matter. Mr. Wyshak, who's an attorney for Johnny Meyer, said a handwriting expert examined the document and said there was a question about the authenticity of Howard Hughes' signature. Anderson permitted full exploration of the issue to continue. They've asked the judge to continue about when Howard Hughes wrote his name, how he wrote his name, the last time he wrote his name. The attorneys in this case were given until December, late December, to take depositions from two of Howard Hughes' aides and the Mexican authorities and of a mysterious woman courier named as the source of Meyer's documents. The attorneys for both sides are going to have a hearing on Tuesday. The woman lives in Vancouver. Summa attorneys told the court that the documents introduced earlier by Meyer were not among the files returned to the company by the Mexican Attorney General, and we think they are fictitious. Wyshak did not identify the origin of the bank loan memo. What the bank loan memo said, whoever got this money, because Howard Hughes couldn't use it, he was a prisoner, he was an invalid, he was drugged, and somebody has paid themselves off for unexplained reasons and taken out $15 million, another $5 million, another $10 million. I think it added up to $43 million shortly before he died. And one of the memos in Mexico said, in quotes, "I have signed HRH's signature to the three promissory notes from the First City National Bank of the Southwest and the Texas Commerce Bank. He has not been well enough at this time to sign. We will also get a certification to you. Destroy this after reading." Now, this is a memo that was in the Hughes headquarters. It wasn't shredded when the Mexican police went in. And this is an allegation that there's no way that Howard Hughes was well enough to sign his name. Now, what Johnny Meyer is trying to do on the basis of this huge $9 million civil suit is to say Howard Hughes couldn't order me to be sued because Hughes didn't sign the papers. And he can break wide open, if he could break open my allegations of whether or not you signed anything at all from 1957 to 66, and certainly never after 66. I don't believe he was on the continent of the United States. But this former aide now has been charged with swindling them out of some landmine deals. So he has sent a courier to Mexico to get evidence that not only did Hughes not sign these documents, but and the forgery existed, but he also has evidence that maybe the lawsuit against him was not signed by Howard Hughes. And then that goes all the way back to the sale of TWA stock and all the documents Hughes handled. And then you begin to ask yourself, what did Howard Hughes sign and when did he sign it? We're talking now about millions of dollars, $43 million, $10, $5 million. A man's confined and a signature is used, and by their own admission, it wasn't his signature. So therefore, how valid is any lawsuit against people if Howard Hughes' signature isn't even on there? We don't know his state of mind. There's another article from the Las Vegas Sun. I started taking that paper just a few weeks ago. I should have taken it through Watergate. And it's an article about Howard Hughes being kept a recluse. It says, "Hughes kept a recluse," and it's by Jerry Bellett, special to the Las Vegas Sun. Now, this story isn't carried by the United Press or Associated Press. This isn't in the New York Times or the Washington Post yet, or the Los Angeles Times. So what I have here are three articles from three different papers. I take 10 papers a day, but what I'm trying to show is the suppression of the news is so bad that people don't understand how much is coming out about the Hughes story. And there's no way to, unless you're crazy enough to take as many newspapers as I do every day. Well, in the Las Vegas Sun, they have an article, "Hughes was kept a recluse. Further evidence that Howard Hughes wanted to end his stunt as the world's most celebrated recluse is contained in hordes of Hughes documents." Now, Johnny Meyer is a continuation of the other story, but not the same. Got 4,000 documents that were seized by the Mexican authorities. And that puts him in a tremendous amount of power to drop lawsuits against him, to have tremendous wealth, to blackmail the entire Justice Department, to blackmail the CIA and the FBI. If Johnny Myers has the evidence of the Howard Hughes case and the Mexican documents, he's a very powerful man. He's living in Vancouver, but information is power, and if he uses it right, he'll be very wealthy and powerful. And he claims that whoever had Howard Hughes wouldn't let him out, that he was literally kidnapped and confined to his room, and that he wanted to come out at the time of Watergate, and he got memos to get away, don't cause publicity, and don't make any waves. Now, that's important, because if there were a double of Howard Hughes living there who was going to be starved off, you have to believe that if Howard Hughes was not buried in 1976, then the only explanation of what happened in Houston, Texas, is that a double of Howard Hughes was kept and starved and made to get skinny and had some brain surgery and was emaciated, and that the double was buried. So there was a man that was screaming in pain. There was a man getting injections. There was a man buried in Houston, Texas, in an unmarked grave. But whether or not it was Howard, I don't think it was Howard. But this document of Johnny Myers says that whoever was Hughes or was called Hughes wanted desperately to get out. He wanted to end his silence and get out, and he wasn't allowed to. And a writer named Jerry Bellett says in the previous memo from Johnny Myers that was made public, there isn't any single clue why Hughes wanted to end his self-imposed exile. But all from his closest aides, they say that he should stay inside, and yet there isn't a clue on why the suggestion of why he wanted to stop being in exile. It could be that a man were a double and wanted to get out, because if he just got out on the Watergate thing, then he could, like running over the Iron Curtain, be home and safe or free if he isn't killed. This article says, if Hughes wanted to confront his detractors, Johnny Myers has documents to show that Hughes' staff did not want Howard Hughes to be seen by any person. The staff wouldn't allow anyone to see him. A lot of Hughes' daily activities show that he was taking a number of different drugs. This is what I said all along, that Hughes was hyped since 1957 and was given injections and kept quiet while he took his fingerprints or whatever, but enough to keep him a body there that would be representative as a bashful Hughes. And this article says that the indications from the Mexican papers is that this body was taking heavy doses of drugs. And then it goes on to say, another minor mystery concerning Hughes last year is why he went to Mexico in February of 1976, when in August of 75 he was only arrested in the Bahamas, Vancouver, Canada for 4 or 5 months. And I've asked many times, why would they move that body, that scabby body with a brain tumor, over to Mexico and not keep it in the Bahamas? And these people writing for the Las Vegas Sun have an answer. They said that if Hughes had died, and they knew he was dying, and these people haven't been charged with murder or kidnapping, but they knew he was dying, and no, they didn't want him to die in the Bahamas or Canada, which are part of the British Commonwealth. They said that the organization thought it could control events better in Mexico than in other countries. Now, what do they mean by controlling events? There were no kidney machines, there was no life support systems for Hughes. Does it mean that if that wasn't used, or if a man were just barely living and dying, they knew just when to call in the person to say that Howard Hughes had expired at a certain time? The article says, according to Johnny Myers, that it was obvious that Hughes was dying, and no one wanted him to die in the Bahamas or Canada, which is part of the British Commonwealth. He said the organization could control events better in Mexico, but the Mexican authorities trapped them. They raided the Hughes Acapulco headquarters, and according to the sources in Mexico, the police wanted to investigate Hughes' condition. They were suspicious of his condition. As a matter of fact, the Hughes assistants, I read one article that they paid $3,000 for a piece of equipment to come in at the time that Hughes was dying, and I wondered if it was a frozen body at the end that was brought in that they paid that much for. But the decision of the Mexican officials was to go in and see Hughes on Monday. And also, there were people at the hotel that didn't believe that Hughes was there, and there's a lot of question about it. So when the weekend came, they decided to wait till the weekend was over. And Monday, April the 5th, before they could get in there, Hughes was on an airplane, and he died on the plane. But when the police went into the apartment, they found the aides shredding documents in Yu's suite. And the ones they didn't destroy were confiscated by the police, about 400 documents. Now, you can imagine what was in those documents. If the man was dying, God knows he was on the brink of death, I wonder what they were doing for weeks before or why they even kept the documents around. But I think it's highly unusual in the case of a state, and particularly since here's a man who has, it seems, no will, no known will, that these men had a shredding machine and documents, and after Howard Hughes was put on the plane and flown to Texas, these men were in there shredding up and destroying all these documents that would give us the real history of the Hughes case. They were shredding these documents. Johnny Meyer has copies of documents that he saved from the shredder, and he claims the Mexican authorities were offered $1 million by the Texas Attorney General's office to hand them over and were refused. Now, this is interesting. When documents were stolen from the Hughes headquarters in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Police Department offered $1 million for people who turned in any evidence because of these top-secret operations. But I think the Attorney General of Texas, his name's John Hill, I've spoken to him on the phone, I've sent him many letters, he is trying to break the case of the state of mind of Howard Hughes, just the state of mind. Could he function? Who wrote these checks? What were they for? Who was taking care of him? Was it negligence? He's trying to get answers to the Hughes case, and John Meyer, the Attorney General of Texas, and he can't get answers to these stories, and they keep coming out. And it's very interesting. The state of Texas is putting up $1 million for the Mexican documents that were taken of Howard Hughes. What would the Mexican people know? What would the Hughes Tool Company find out if he sold the Hughes Tool Company for a certain amount of millions of dollars, and it comes out that he wasn't alive at the time it was sold in 1972? What if Howard Hughes was kidnapped? What if he was murdered? What if he was buried by Onassis? What if these men have been forging his name since the TWA stock was sold? Who in Texas wants to put up $1 million to get those papers? And don't they know, after paying that price, that the Mexican officials must have copied them 10 times over with copying machines today and 5 or 10 cents a page? It's hard to believe that even if they were sold for $1 million, they wouldn't have copies of the Howard Hughes story. Hughes is so important to this whole Cold War saga, as I say, that it's unbelievable that $1 million was offered and the papers weren't even turned over to the Attorney General of Texas. Then there's a third article about Howard Hughes living like a prisoner, based on his bedridden, indecisive days, a new book, a Random House, that I want to mention. But in terms of Howard Hughes' life and existence, I just want to read a page last year from the Rules Committee in Congress. This is the Congress of the United States, and Mr. Downing, member of Congress, is talking to Henry Gonzalez, another member of Congress, and Chairman Madden, and they were talking about investigating the John Kennedy assassination. At that time, it was before the Rules Committee. And Chairman Madden said this would be a mammoth undertaking. Mr. Downing said they want to study the assassination, the death of President Kennedy, and Madden said that would be a mammoth undertaking. And Mr. Downing said, no, we'd focus on Kennedy. And Mr. Gonzalez said, is that all? And they said, well, how about Jimmy Hoffa? And Downing said, no. And then Chairman Madden said, would our investigation include Howard Hughes? I read where he had disappeared. This was in March, and Hughes's body was cashed in April. This was a week before the Hughes body was brought in. And Chairman Madden said, would it include Howard Hughes? I read an article where he disappeared. And Congressman Downing said, not unless the committee deemed it necessary. And I find it hard to believe a committee would deem that investigation necessary. And Chairman Madden then said, well, it is mysterious. The papers are printing about his disappearance, and the FBI and CIA and everybody seem to be falling down on the job. So the papers were printing the fact that a non-existent Howard Hughes in March 31st, 1976, and I think it's interesting that the Congress decided they wouldn't investigate that, they stick with John Kennedy. Well, there is an article, Associated Press story today, based on this new book of Howard Hughes, that he was indecisive, bedridden, helpless, couldn't run his business, and that is in contrast to the people who say they saw Hughes, that he was debonair and clear-headed and knew, had his wits about him. A private investigator, J.J. Arms, said he saw him in 1974. the controversies of the dead, bedridden, indecisive, joyless, half-lunatic youths are going to be one version of history. The other version is going to be this man that was personable, well-liked, sat and watched movies and had all of his rockers. And the truth is really going to go back, I believe, to the mystery of youths disappearing in 66, not being seen since 57. There are many articles coming out from many newspapers around the country on youths. Save them and read them for years to come. Save them now because you'll lose them later, and then read them, and we'll do more on the youths maybe next week. That's all for this week on Dialogue Conspiracy. Our time is up. This is KLRB, and I'll see you next Monday afternoon from Carmel, California.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for many years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.